So I think this is the start of our Lightning Talk session for Friday. Are we live? Are we outside already? Yes, Agata is coming. So we have a lot of inscriptions. What do you say? How do you call it? Or whatever. People who want to have talks, we're probably not going to make it all the way through to 10. But if everyone's trying to be brief, we'll see. So around minus what we are just losing right now, like around 5 minutes, and then maybe we have a chance. Dagata is still setting up her bag. Laptop is already there, so I can maybe prepare some people. Simon is second. Maybe you could also start. We changed the order. That would be better. But you need a microphone. Would you do a hand microphone? That one? Yeah, okay. Simon, let's give it up for Simon, who's starting the session.
Okay, I just have three short inputs. The first is an event announcement. So as you might have already heard in the previous session, we have from 13th to 16th of May in Linz, the Arts Meet Radical Openness Festival. It's very close to here, so about 2 hours by train or so. And it's in some ways very related to what we do here at LibreGraphics Meeting. It's also about open source software, free software. It's about critical approaches to technology, political implications of technology, ecological implications, and all that. It's also a very familiar, nice setting. So warm recommendation if you're in the area to come by. Something somewhat similar. Another festival in Austria, that's the Hockmas Castle, so something like Let's Hack the Castle. And that's happening in Ottenschlag in Upper Austria, which is also kind of close to Linz, also the same distance from here, but not as easy to reach. This is an event which is somewhat situated in the chaos bubble, so of the CCC, sort of the tentacles reaching out to Austria. And yeah, it's organized by various hackerspaces in Austria and also from Germany. And maybe also internationally. And yeah, so it's like a camp, like the CCC camp, if you will, just in a castle. And yeah, it's an option to go to if you like these kinds of events. And so my last input here is that we've all seen the great State of the LibreGraphics presentation that Mark Alessandro made. And something that I wanted to do last year but didn't get to do is to take all this work that he put in there and submit this to another conference, which would have been in the context of sort of proprietary computer graphics, and to just really go there as an almost alien and present all these great projects that are there. Because I think if even here at this event, people say, oh, wow, I didn't know these 5 projects, or I didn't know this, or didn't know that. Imagine what the impact is if you go to a conference where everybody is just steeped in the whole Adobe ecosystem, and they're like, whoa, what's going on? All these projects, I had no idea. So yeah, that's just a recommendation. I mean, all the slides are there, all the work has been done by Mark Alexandra. And you can basically just resubmit this somewhere, present it. Even it's down to the words that you have to speak already on paper or on digital paper. So yeah, maybe something that you might want to consider. And that's all from me. Thank you.
Okay.
We have a flying changeover with Agata, who is reusing the laptop, so that should be quick. So thank you.
See this. Oh, this is which what should I click? Because I don't know German.
On the upper right, dear show. And the right side at the top. Left. No. I was exactly the wrong.
This.
Left. That. Yeah.
Great. So this is the presentation about how to put your application on Steam the right way, which is to get as much money and fame as you can get. You probably want money because it can fund development and at least one core developer is kind of nice to have. And you probably want fame because popularity means more users and contributors. And Steam is unique in the way because it shows you to people who have never heard of you. Like, yeah. So the first rule is don't release it, or I'll be very upset. First, you need to prepare the Steam page, which looks like this. What's important is that you can't just like take your splash screen or your like promotional artwork and just add logo and add it on Steam, because it won't really work as the main art on Steam, because it should suggest the type of applications you are. And the trailer also needs to be practically made for Steam or like for stores. And other things also have like some rules. So when you do this, go search for those rules or like contact me. The most important rule is translations, because Steam won't show your Steam page to people, even when they search and the exact name. If they have like Steam in German and your application isn't in German, then it just won't show up. So translations of the Steam pages are like very important, even if your applications aren't translated. Then you need to wait. There are two things that you want. First is place in popular upcoming, which is special place that I will show in a moment. And the second is as many wish lists as possible. Wishes is there's like a button on a Steam page before you release. Users can click on it that they want to buy it. And you want as many as possible. So this is just like a little thing on the Steam page. You need to scroll down. It looks not important, but it gives you quite a lot of like promotion on the release. And after you release, you also might happen to show up here. This is another thing, and it's also very good to be there. And you basically need like around this amount of wish lists to appear in those lists. And if you can achieve that, you need to achieve that, basically. You should wait at least like 6 months to give it a fair chance, but you can wait for a year. But if you just don't release before you appear in that list. Yeah. So there is like a thing that's called Next First, which I also won't describe really. If you want to read, then you can read, but you need to appear in it before the release. So, like, there are a lot of rules on Steam, basically. You can also, like, promote it in some other ways. You can have, like, just promote it as much as possible before the release. Because on release, Steam does, like, this whole promotion thing. And this is the best chance for you to gain all of that money and fame, because later it's way more difficult to get this kind of promotion from Steam. After the release, you can still do some things like daily deal. I will also mention that in a moment. There are like summer sale and stuff. There are discounts, which you also need to make at least 20%, because then Steam will send emails to people who wishlisted. Yes. And you can see, where is it? Okay, yet or not? Okay. Okay, yes. So this is like a Krita daily deal, because we didn't do all the smart things that we should do, because we didn't know about it. But we are now trying to do things the Steam way. And here's the first. the LED. This is the chart of users in the app at the moment. So this, of course, means that a lot of more users came. This is like first Christmas, second Christmas, and this is daily deal on Monday, on this Monday. Yeah. And this is like, number of reviews. It kind of, parallels with money. You can see pandemic. Here we started doing Steam in like a proper way. Kind of. Here's the pandemic. Here's the first daily deal. And the last one isn't really visible yet. So it shows that it's worth doing. This is the guy that I all know all of it from. And this is my contact information. That's all.
Thank you very much. Ooh, that was loud. We have Nate is going to be next, and I think you're going just to switch over. Maybe you can answer one question or something.
Yeah, I'm curious if you have numbers on how many people discovered you via Steam versus people who just knew Krita and came to Steam to buy it and support you. And also, if people just discover you via Krita and they pay for Krita, do you have like upset users who realize later on that they could have had it for free? So, yeah.
You're asking if like... Like, I don't know how many people from Steam know it from Steam and how many people know it from, like, Krita, but the charts about the daily deal show, daily deal shows your main art on the main page of Steam, which is shown to, like, millions of people. And we had seen increase in sales, so obviously it works somehow. We can't now say on the Steam page that we are free on, unfortunately, elsewhere. We had this text, but we can't now. But usually people just, if they mention that it is free somewhere else, they say that, oh, I just bought it to support development. They really like automatic updates and they really like the amount of hours. So, the amount of people who are upset that it is free somewhere else isn't big. I like have seen maybe one or two comments. So,
okay, thank you very much. Thank you. I think we're going to switch over to Nate now.
Yeah, but
yep. Yeah, okay, just like that.
All right. So I hear this came up yesterday in the Rewire talk, and so I just wanted to share my experience with having some LibreGraphics appearances at local regional events. It's not the only way to do things, but I can tell you what I've been through, and maybe that's helpful. I think we did this once at Texas Linux Fest, which bounces around between different big cities in Texas, and three times at Scale, if I'm wrong, Tom Lechner might know. Scale is always in Pasadena. It's Southern California Linux Expo. And those are both regional events, so people from the area, they happen over a long weekend. They have an open call for papers, and any topic is available. Tom has also proposed a track at FOSSI, which is a regional event in Portland. That's his to talk about. In each one of those cases, what happened was basically a dedicated track. Obviously, you could just submit a talk about LibreGraphics stuff if you want. But these are all like multi-track events where there's parallel things in multiple rooms. And sometimes you get a named track, so it appears in the schedule, and people will see that. That's good with marketing it to those who might be interested. The way it worked for us was a little team of three or four people, so at Scale, myself and Tom has done this, and Micah Simrick from Pixels, and Pat David from GIMP, and most recently Ted Gould, who was involved in Inkscape for a long time, but is not a core developer these days. Originally, we had talks from developers of graphics applications and people who were sort of talking about how to do stuff just in sort of a normal session format. But the past 2 years at Scale, we've done a workshop track, basically. So like a 90-minute session for each one. And to my surprise, people turned up for that. I think the biggest that we had in the first year was 34-ish people, and that was for a Blender talk. The lesser ones were, you know, half that, but it's still someone's giving 90 minutes to talk about Darktable or Godot or something. That was a suggestion from the organizer of the event. He said, like, people are going to show up for a tutorial style event where they wouldn't just hear a lecture. And I think this is important to realize that what the audience wants is not necessarily what developers want. The local events tend to be people who can't take a week off of work, or they'll go because it's a weekend and they don't have to drive very far. And as a percentage of the attendees, a lot more people are just, you know, users, interested users who are going to spend time and money to be there, but they're not necessarily developers. And what that means is that the practical stuff of here's how you do things in GIMP is more interesting to them and more relevant to how they want to spend their time than what's new in the latest release, like a changelog kind of talk, which you can always do because stuff's always changing. It's also a good idea to start with a tutorial session if you can, because you don't need as many people. Like, you don't need as many speakers. You can fill up a day with like three or four of those instead of six or seven. So a track gets filled out easily. I think it's also less stressful for the speakers because typically tutorials are, you know, not on camera. They're not in as big of a room. You get more just back and forth with people and helping them with their photos or their designs or whatever. And you can also cherry pick the content. So, you know, you want a Blender talk, you can just go find one. Let's see. On the other hand, I think you do need to realize that you probably want to be part of the main call for papers if you can, and get some buy-in from people organizing the event. That's almost necessary. You probably need a couple of people, three people. It really helps if someone is local to the area because they can be more in tune to what the venue is like and that sort of thing. It's really best if you want to do this to an event that you already go to, you've been to yourself more than once, so you know what to expect. And don't wait till the last minute. I kind of waited till the last minute this past year at Scale, and we still got people there, but it's, you know, more stressful for you. I would say just try it. If there's an event about free software in your area, think about putting together a day of a couple of tutorial type sessions about Libre Graphics. You can show it off. It helps people who don't know what it is otherwise, and it definitely helps people who have heard of it but maybe would like to see some hands-on explanations of what they can do and how they can do it, because it's not always obvious. So that's all. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nate. Does anyone have questions? Oh, you can already set up yourself, I think. We don't have a lot of questions, so we have to wait for the switch over. There's a question. Great.
Hate to say it, but not quite a question, more of a comment. You mentioned Fosse. It was in Portland. It's moving to Vancouver, Canada. So if anyone wants to do like art-related stuff for Fosse in Canada, the call for papers is April 30th.
Great, thanks. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Thank you, Raphael. The stage is yours.
Okay. I am not ready. Screen mirroring. Change to entire screen. Start mirroring. What? Okay. Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, all right. Is it going to be a grab bag of things? Oh, incredible. Yeah, just some fun stuff I've been working on lately and a little processing update at the end. This for people who use P5.js is called Millefeuille, and I've always liked layer systems like in Photoshop or Procreate or GIMP. This is kind of a simple layer system that you can add to your sketch, and it uses the frame buffers support in P5.js that was added fairly recently. And yeah, it automatically creates this UI, and it's nice. Another thing for P5.js users, this is my little scaffolding tool, Create P5.js, which lets you quickly scaffold P5.js project, picking the version you want, whether you want to download the files locally or use a CDN, and then it scaffolds everything, and so you have your project that you can run automatically. That's nice. And for people who are ever in Berlin, we have a community today. Another ambassador of Creative Code Berlin is Abe here. We run meetups every month. If you're curious what that looks like, you can check the notes that we take every time. And we have an archive of all of our meetups going back to when we started. We do this every first Friday of the month, Creative Code Stammtisch. The next one is on the 1st of May. So if you're in Berlin, after you're done fighting the police, you can come to a nice Creative Code meetup. All right, completely other topic. This year, Processing is celebrating its 25th anniversary. This is a fun article by Dave Pagurek about porting a Processing sketch from the very earliest versions all the way to more recent things, more recent versions, and then even to P5.js. And to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Processing, we're hosting events, or at least, you're hosting events, right? We are bringing back Processing Community Day around the world. We already have over 20 cities registered, but there are some notable empty spaces on the map. So maybe you want to become one of those dots and organize a fun event wherever you are. It will be added here. So this is a custom website that I built for this. And if you want to submit your event, you can do so by following the steps here. Post a forum thread on the forum and add your event to the map by filling this form. If you don't want to use GitHub, send me an email, I guess, and I'll add it for you. And PCD has existed before in various parts of the world. But since 2019, we haven't officially been running a global initiative for it. Some of the chapters continued by themselves, but this year we want to bring everybody together. It will be in October, so you have a little bit of time to think about what that can be. And it doesn't have to be a huge event either. It can just be like a bunch of people in a cafe talking about creative coding. That's totally valid as a PCD. Maybe if it's just you and your friend, that's not a PCD. But if it's three of you, then it is. If you have questions about that, you can, of course, come ask me, but you'll find all the information on this website, day.processing.org. There you go. It's gone. Day.processing.org. It's Processing Community Day. And a final shameless plug. I run a weekly creative code challenge on Open Processing, openprocessing.org. And every week since 2021, I think, people are making all sorts of fun things, often with P5.js, but not only. Like, also, we have some really fantastic shader coders and people who do all sorts of fun stuff. I don't know, I'm clicking something randomly. There you go. And we have a different theme every week. And you can find this on Open Processing right there. Yeah, that's about 5 minutes. I guess that's going to do for today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Anyone questions for Rafael? Questions? How can I register? I just go to website. I'm going to host Nuremberg.
Yeah, so to register, you go to the website. If you're not on the Processing forum, you can create an account, post on the main thread to tell us that you, post a forum thread. This will pre-populate the thread, the message, by the way, so you don't even have to think. You can just add your city name. And then you can create the event. If you post this, or if you ask me, I'll give you the steps, but just follow these three steps and then you'll be good. It will create a pull request automatically for you on the map and I'll review it and add it. And if there's any questions in the process, I'm here to answer.
Nice. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Questions? No. Thanks. So I'll switch over to Julia.
Yes.
With that laptop. You talked about that before, right? Oh, that's so quick. Thanks.
You've got a fill while I type, Lasse.
Oh, yeah. Should I tell us something? Yeah. Oh, shit. That looks good. Ready?
Yep. Okay. So I'm talking about an old thing because it's come to my attention that not everyone has been here for 15 years, and so it's not an old thing for everyone. This made the rounds yesterday during the nice fishbowl time, and many people were interested and curious about it because they hadn't seen it before, which was a bit confronting for me because this was my life for 5 years. So the thing I am showing you right now is LibreGraphics magazine, which originally came out of LibreGraphics meeting 2010 in Brussels, when Femke Snelting asked Ana Isabel Carvalho, my apologies, it's a good thing she's not here to hear me say that, Ricardo Lafuente and myself to produce this little publication to be distributed at the end of that LGM. So we worked frantically throughout LGM 2010, and on the last day, this wonderful box of these little things, which are now collector's editions, arrived. And the three of us liked working together so much that we said, well, maybe we should make it a real thing. And so from 2010 until 2016, we published this actual print-first, professional-quality, entirely floss pipeline, real magazine, which was targeted towards artists and designers who we thought might not think that floss was something for them, might not think that it's possible to actually do full-on professional workflows in floss, because that was a thing we heard a lot of people say before. So what is wonderful, I think, and awesome about this is, for example, we did everything on Git. So the entire thing is version controlled. You can still access the source code of every issue we ever made, including when there's an SVG, you can just get the SVG. I don't remember the licensing. I think it's CC by SA probably. But you can make use of all of the stuff we made over 6 years and 8 issues of this really high quality magazine. But also, importantly, when we finally stopped doing it, after 6 years, we went, okay, that was a lot. This is eating a lot of our lives. We want to do other things. We, Anna and Ricardo made this wonderful archive. So the goal with the magazine had been to do something that was print first, because we were all originally graphic designers by training, and graphic designers love print. So in the end, we decided that we wanted to have something that would live on nicely as a digital first version of the magazine. So in addition to all of the old beautiful PDFs that are actually designed, you know, as layouts for print, you can also now read, as of like still 8 years ago, so this is not news, but you can read the digital first versions of these things. Including, and this is quite fun, we have Christoph Hack, who is answering, yes, Christoph, right in the back, answering some questions for us about his relationship to LibreGraphics, including who his biggest floss influence is, which is apparently Florian Kramer. I now know, having sent him these questions myself many years ago and having just reread this today. But there's all kinds of beautiful stuff, 6 years of publications, which is, you know, 8 publications because we were very slow, which you can get at archive.librographicsmag.com. And if you weren't around 15 years ago when this was happening, maybe you'll find it useful. We always tried to make it useful as an entry point for people who were new to floss. So there's also some great definitions. And that's it. That's what I've got. Look at our website.
Thank you. Okay, that's a question already.
I was just poking around the GitLab archive, and I noticed that somebody even committed the Scribus autosave files. Was that intentional?
That may have been me. I was using Sparkle Share to manage my my Git contributions. Yeah, so possibly my fault.
Another question incoming.
For those who don't know Sparkle Share, it's basically like Dropbox, but for Git. And it still exists, and it's still being developed, and being ported to Rust.
Why don't you restart maybe LibGraphics Magazine 2027? Would be cool.
Yeah. Bring us to Linz a week early, and pay for the printing, and then we can talk.
I have a printer in the basement. You can have that.
No, Lasse, the point of it was that it was beautiful. It was not jank. It was print first and wonderful.
How much is it?
How much is it?
Yeah, approximately like a printing for this kind of...
Depends on the print run, depends on the paper. And of course, we were doing this 10 years ago and paper costs have gone up. 15 years ago. And paper costs have gone up a lot since then. So I would not like to comment on how much a print run would cost. But generally, the per copy price goes down the more you print. So if you want 1,000 of them, it gets much cheaper.
Yeah, true thing about printing.
Exactly.
And wonderful archive. I definitely need to browse it to learn a bit more about the elders, you know. If there are no more questions, I would say thank you, Ginger, and welcome, Helen. You need the handset, don't you?
There you go. There's an incognito window. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to talk about is also going back into the past. Do anyone here, do you remember floss manuals? Yep. So for those of you who don't know, it was started in 2006 by Adam Hyde as a response to the lack of good user documentation for open source software. And it developed quite a big community with manuals being produced for all kinds of different software and in quite a few different languages as well. And it kind of had a peak in the sort of, 2009, 2010 kind of time, and then started to drop away, partly because software started making better manuals themselves, so the urgency was not quite the same. But it did generate a really big community for quite a while, and a lot of people here would have participated in that also. And it kind of got left in the hands of Mick Chesterman in the UK, who had some babies and studied and did things and sort of was just keeping it active at a really, really low level. And just recently he got excited and motivated again and said, we should reboot it. And I've got a flyer here which says a bit more about it, but he's redone the website. And you can, yeah, this is actually not looking quite like it was looking before. Maybe there was, the links are not working. Maybe that's all there is there at the moment. Anyway, Mick is quite keen to see whether people are interested in archiving things from the past and looking at all of the manuals that still exist there, what's relevant, what can be updated, and also making connections back into the community. So I've got flyers here that give you the website and you can pass those around. And if you're interested in ways to network about software manual documentation, then please have a look. It's really at the moment only Mick, me and a guy called Martin in New Zealand. I think others on the mailing list haven't really responded, but maybe there's some interest. out there. And the other thing I will just briefly mention as well is Sister Server and the Eclectic Tech Carnival. This is a feminist server project. So we have a server where we host a number of different things like PeerTube and Nextcloud and Mastodon and GitLab and mailing lists and websites. And it's a place for feminist people to try things out, to learn together, to share skills. And we have the Eclectic Tech Carnival. I've got one of the t-shirts on here. That happens spontaneously every now and again in random places. And it's about tech and art and feminism. And you can find out about that one on the Eclectic Tech Carnival website. So that was from last year. And actually, the conversation today about archiving and events on the website of Libra Graphics was making me think about the ETC website, because we have the same problem that every time another event is organised, the local group will come in and make a new website. And sometimes the archives just kind of disappear for a while. But they're usually still able to be found. And, this issue of archiving and keeping the present and the past together is a big thing. So, yeah, that's me.
That's it. Thank you very much. Amazing resources. Maybe you have some more questions about this. I don't know. Oh, that was loud. Okay. Ma, it's your turn, but I think you need to set up your laptop, right? We are very well in time, so I can already prepare Simon Budik. You will be on today. And Johannes, you might be on as well. So, that's okay. You should ask Simon, are you bringing a laptop on stage? Are you bringing a laptop? With a browser, what do you need? You need a way to show the notes you have on your phone. Would you right now write a presentation, or would you hold? If you can do it without, then just do it without. I mean, you're not well prepared, so do it badly prepared. Okay, great. Are you ready? All right.
Yeah. Okay. Sound. Huh? Yeah. Okay. I'm going to try to do that fast. I'm going to try not to talk about myself, because that's not why I'm here. My name is Ma, with a circumflex accent on the A. But I think it's important to understand where tools come from. And for the past 25 years, I've been a digital craftsman. There were no tools when I started, so I started to build my own tools because people asked me to do stuff, and I did a lot of very different stuff, mainly interactive installation, process control in real time, and I did all of that using my own tools, AAA Seed. And so I want to show you a little bit. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I tried to do a small demo, even if we're not really ready. But so this is the kind of stuff I do myself. This is the kind of stuff I like to do, very reactive installation with no explanation, where people just dive in and play with the stuff. And one of the major thing I did, which make me think about a lot of the future, what I was doing, was this game in we ran for a year and a half in the Science Museum in Paris. It was games on epidemics. You were playing scenarios of like four games of 5, 15, 20 minutes. We could have like 80 people playing on a 500 square meter for 20 minutes. And this was done in 2008. So slowly my specialty became immersive, massive installation. So I'm using the video game technology applied to other contexts, like a lot of people. It go from the really technical C++, OpenGL, OpenCL, and all of this, but there is a scripting layer on top of it, which make it really, really flexible. And the tool got really matured and got robustness and granularity as in front of real challenge. So in 2020, we were a small team to make this thing. At the Aquarium Museo Scenographic de Monaco. And they wanted something was like real time, but was also photorealistic, which usually I don't like to do. But that was really a difficult, how to say it? I don't have the word in English. A difficult thing for the team to do this. But we managed to do it. We had like 40 projectors and a dozen of PC to do this. And when we finished this, we had some kind of debrief. We realized how the tool changed, how the scripting became central, and how the user interface changed a lot. So, and also how the iteration is important. It's important that developer could iterate, that artists could iterate, and that could we do all this iteration while the real-time kernel was running without having to restart, recompile, or re-go to the same place. So... okay, but it's nice to do that, but it's difficult to make something strong when you're always in production. So in 2020, I became part of a European project which funded me for 3 years to be able to move these things to real time, to open source, free. We are under an MIT license, a C++ base have been clean, and we evolve a lot the Lua layer on top of it. So, a demo? We're already in it. That's how I do my slide. To do my slide, I'm just using a worksheet where I put my text, my images, and so on, and I can change it over here and change my slide directly. It's a little bit different. It's not node-based in the sense of you don't plug node to the other. You can see this orange line here, which is the order the blocks are executed. Sorry. So, for example, if I want to add something on top of my presentation, I can do it this way. And if I want to change texture, I don't have to plug or replug. Usually, I just go inside a layer and choose what I want over there. One thing is like the interface is 3D. So that's going to be real nice to be able to use it in VR. The interface is totally scriptable. So here I can go into the Lua script. I'm going to try to do something that I didn't check before, but it's okay. I'm doing something simple. Let's not be too risky. Okay, you see this button here? I'm just gonna make it like I'm gonna make it like twice as big. Oh, a bug. Oh, I have a bug. It tell me which line is it. So line 45. A real demo. What did I do? Oh yeah, of course I didn't type the thing. Numlock. Sorry, I start to be visually impaired. Okay, save. Okay. Didn't have to reboot. The thing is still running. And now I can reboot my interface and the size of the button change. We found another bug, but it's okay. So you can add layers on top of each other. You can change the order. You can do a lot of things. And there is more and more blocks. Let's do a little bit of audio reactive. Let's add a Voronoi pass on it. And oh, yeah, great. The interface looks strange, but it's very efficient, and it has been used in very, very difficult conditions. So let's go back to the slides. Let's cut all of this. Oh no, we need the logo of the RGM. The logo is back. Let's get rid of this. So if you want to know more, that's where you can go. Also, I think we should have a V1. I'm not happy with the documentation yet. In 2026, it's June. Software is pretty strong. I have it running for like 4 months, 7/7, 24 hours a day. I had to stop because of Windows. And last thing also, I'm trying to maintain this thing and digital cuisine. So if you go on the website, I'm done, and you go here. It's a set of slides that I'm trying to keep. Ah, there's a web browser not working. Okay, not important, but it's over there. So it's slides that I'm trying to maintain. It's like 86 slides now with all the tools to do real-time live.
Thank you very much. Rachel, I think we're going to have Simon set up, and in the meantime, we try to maybe answer one more question, if there's anything. Otherwise, I love the demo. It's really cool.
No question? Okay.
Thank you. Oh, with the Winky Katze. You got to buy the video team around now. Okay, if we stick to 6 minutes each, we get the last two speakers. Would be awesome. Simon, as soon as you're ready, I leave the stage.
Okay, I think I'm ready. As many of you know, I'm a lot into colorful light objects. And this, what I have here, is an example, a small version, basically, of a project I call Lichtschnuppe, which is probably not translatable to German. It's a pun of words based with shooting star and light, basically. So together with CCC, I did a bigger project. They are exist in like 2.50 meters. And while developing the software for this, I'm facing a specific problem, because I need to represent gradients in some sort of configuration file or in short messages transmitted over low bandwidth networks to describe this. So I'm thinking right now, and I want to emphasize, there is no code written. This is basically just asking for your input. I want to find a way to have short text strings as expressive as possible to describe different gradients. So for example, this could be a description for the gradients you see on the top. You have like three color specifications, and implied is a linear interpolation between the colors. And I wait a second, I should just close this. We have linear interpolation between the three colors. So these three color descriptions basically have described two segments with endpoint colors, basically. So this would be maybe a little bit more verbose, where the dash basically indicates linear interpolation. This is very much modeled after the or inspired by the way GIMP represents gradients. So their midpoints along the gradient can have a left side and a right side color. So this would be maybe the representation where the middle node basically switches between the colors on the left and the right side. And this might be a representation. You see that there now the minus indicating the linear interpolation is replaced by a vertical bar indicating a step transition within the segment. And this would be back again to the linear interpolation. Another thing is in GIMP, you can move the little triangles at the bottom, so the segments can have different lengths. So maybe this could be a way to indicate that the left segment is 2 units wide, the right is 1 unit wide. Yeah, this could be extended, of course. I think you can see you could add more colors and define different transition types. And so another thing that's possible in GIMP is that if you have like a regular linear interpolation between three colors, you can change the midpoint. So this would be, for example, the 0.9 would indicate that the midpoint is 90% in the length of the segment. This might be a way to describe colors. The hash mark notation is pretty much known and established, so that makes sense to reuse it. The at sign might be a way to describe color space in the HSV color space, basically indicating a color wheel. That was my idea there. These are the different segment interpolation. How does the transition from one color to the next actually work? I don't have a good letter found for the curved transition yet. And the segments could have properties. The length indicated as an integer value, basically in the end indicating a proportion of the sum of all segment lengths. And if there is a float indicated by a point, this might be helpful for indicating the midpoint of a segment. This is also something I have not really found something yet. In GIMP, you can have different ways how to, which color space to use to interpolate between the colors. And that's about it. That's just some rough thinking about how this might work. The basic problem is that I want to have a compact representation in text form that's understandable, but it doesn't have to be user-friendly necessarily. It needs to be compact because microcontrollers have limited amounts of storage and processing power, so I can't have an SVG parser to just be able to understand gradients, basically. So I would very much welcome to discuss this with you. So if there are any questions, I don't think we can enter a full-blown discussion now, but if there are any quick questions, I can try to answer them.
Yes, we can maybe switch over to Johannes and... Oh, we have 6 minutes left. You can do whatever you want with the time or we end the session. But we can have question and answers, definitely. There's no orders, which is the last person. Yeah, 1 minute is perfect.
So I'm sorry. So I see that you're trying to find a balance between human readability and compressibility. And I do wonder if that is, because it's not very readable. And I do wonder if there's kind of, if you should move towards being more compressible and less human readable. Like, I feel like G-code, for example, is like a good example.
Sorry, I have trouble hearing you, actually.
Yeah, I'm just saying maybe, you know, G-code for
again,
pen plotter, G-code. Yes.
That would be very different.
Well, I mean, in terms of being more compressible rather than human readable.
My goal is to have this in like small configuration files or stuff like this. I think it would be possible to have some editor basically where you can interactively create your gradient and it boils down to some textual description like this. For comparing to G-code, I think you're referring G-code as in 3D printers or stuff like this. I right now fail to see how to apply this then, but yeah.
I'm not saying to use G-code, but okay. Just ideologically.
Yeah.
What bothers you about CSS notation for linear gradients? Why not just take that one?
To me, it's too verbose, actually. I feel like it needs a lot of keywords and stuff like this that make it quite a long thing, and I'm not sure if it's helping the possibility. And I don't want to have a huge number of keywords, basically, in the firmware for an Atmel AVR microcontroller, something like that.
Why HSV and not something like HSL or HSY? For interpolation, especially.
There's no deeper thought behind that. It's just another idea to express colors, basically, because some people like the HSV way of thinking about colors and don't like thinking in RGB. We could think of other options for LAB or whatever, I don't know. This is just, as I said, it's off the top of my current thinking.
Just looking at the example you've got up on the screen at the moment, have you thought about using, say, two hyphens rather than a hyphen?
Again, sorry?
Have you thought about using two hyphens rather than a hyphen and then the integer as a way of...
Might be possible.
Because it visually, the text looks like the proportionality you've got on the screen.
I also thinking about removing the spaces. So for me, it's not necessarily about having the nicest thing for the user. It's more about like having an expressive way of describing gradients. So.
Okay, so there's 3 minutes left, Johannes. If you are coming to stage now, you might be able to do a quick thing. So you are coming. Okay, great. I'll just get you the hand microphone. You see the time. You can end your thing yourself.
Thank you.
On wheels.
Yes, on wheels. Yeah. Okay. It's a very spontaneous thing. I just had the idea today that I could just only a few hours ago to make have a small talk about mental health and the way we approach a psychological crisis. And mostly I wanted to talk about that many people have issues with this in this area, but it's usually pretty taboo, as we say, see these things as not as transformational crises that we can learn from and that we can grow through, but defects and errors that have to get rid of, we have to get rid of. And oftentimes, what is also connected to this is that we see human beings more in this area, especially tend to see human beings as like bio robots that are broken, instead of seeing these things as mental and really actually mental, as there is no scientific research that can prove that there is actually something wrong in the brain with someone who has experienced a mental crisis. And also the ways we treat people in these states is not really satisfactory and causes a lot of harm. And instead of using these crises to grow from it and to go through these difficult states, instead we are trying to medicate and numb people and take away their freedoms and so on. And what is also very important in this area, that there's no proof that the brain produces consciousness. And there's a lot of research, like in the area of near-death studies, that points to consciousness being non-local and existing independently from the brain. And I would love to see a lot more research in this area instead of, simply treating it as a some sickness that we have to numb and get rid of. And there's actually a lot to learn. And one name I would love to mention is Stanislav Grof. Grof, if you want to look him up, it's like Stanislav with a V at the end and Grof with a F, G-R-O-F. And he did a lot of research in this area and also helped a lot of people through crises such as these. And he termed the coined the term of spiritual emergency. Yeah, that's what I wanted to add. Just very spontaneous. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So many microphones. Thank you very much. If you have questions, maybe you talk to him in the coffee break, which is starting right now.